large majority of parents who accuse the other parent of child abuse lose custody to the abuser. How can a parent protect their children when they have no money to hire top attorneys, have no experience with family court, and are essentially fighting this battle alone? Today's guest is here to offer help. Hello, everyone. My name is Pamela Brewer. Welcome to this edition of Mind Talk. I am pleased to introduce to you attorney Toby Kleinman. Toby Kleinman has helped secure the best outcomes for children involved in custody battles in 45 states for more than two decades. She is also the co-author with Daniel Pollack of Domestic Abuse, Child Custody and Visitation, Winning in Family Court. Toby Kleinman, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you, Pamela. I'm really pleased to be with you today.
Now, Toby, your book was written to take parents step by step through the confusing and emotionally exhausting process of securing the best future for their child. And I noticed that you are described as securing the best outcomes for children versus securing the best outcome for parents, which is usually how it's thought of when parents go to court to try to get custody of their children. Can you say a little bit about that approach, about your thought process?
Well, sure. First of all, there is a major connection between domestic abuse and child abuse. We know that where there is domestic abuse, there is often child abuse. As a matter of fact, the way I got into this particular work was working, doing many, many restraining orders for women in court. And it took me a very short time before I realized that if I was going to do restraining orders for women, I really had to deal with the children. And so, and child custody and the welfare of children is supposed to trump the needs or wants or desires of a parent. So although the courts tend to think of parents as being the prime consideration, because everyone seems to know that parents have constitutional rights, children have legal rights as well. They have the right to be safe and secure in their home. And it becomes incumbent upon the court, where there's an issue of child abuse or child welfare, for the court to essentially take over in what is called the Latin parens patriae, which means a kind of super parent, to oversee the welfare of the child, even where it means stepping on the rights of the parent.
You talk about the importance of using mental health and legal professionals who are aware of the nuances that are associated with abuse. Why is that so particularly important in the case of a relationship where domestic abuse is present?
Everything in the mental health field is subject, like in most fields, is subject to interpretation. If someone does not have adequate training in domestic abuse or child abuse, and yet they're faced with someone who has lived either being abused as a child or being abused as an adult, they will not properly interpret the data, or you risk them not properly interpreting the data. The example I tend to use is, I've heard people say, I've been doing this for a very long time. So what if I didn't go and get trained in domestic abuse or domestic violence? And I say, would you go to a brain surgeon? He says, don't worry about it. I didn't get any training in brain surgery, but I've been doing this for a long time. I don't think we would choose that person. Same thing. There are very important distinctions to be had if somebody has the proper training, from clinical data that they collect during a meeting or an interview, or to tests or the appropriate tests to be given, or how to interpret a test. So these are all critical issues that can be very nuanced. They can seem, when I say it, it's a no-brainer. but I can tell you I still see every day courts relying on improperly unqualified people, in part because it helps the courts run more smoothly. And when you find abuse, the cases tend to be much more litigated.
When you say that it is important that mental health and legal professionals be aware of the nuances of abuse, do you often find, as people are coming into court, and let me just digress for a moment, throughout your book you refer to her as being the victim and him as being the abuser, but you make it clear that there's a recognition that the genders can be switched on either side of the coin. Do you find often that the victim is coming without benefit of mental health support, that they're typically coming in with simply legal support?
Yes. As a matter of fact, one of the things that drew me into wanting this book to be written was the fact that so often victims of abuse come to court expecting the court to fix things that they have lived with for so long. They come to court believing in our judicial system, in our family court system, not knowing how, in my opinion, how broken it is in this particular arena. And so they come, they don't come with, often they come even without counsel, but even if they come with counsel, they expect the court to understand what they've been through, understand what their children have been and may also be going through, and they expect it to be fixed by a judge. Judges have little training. They have some, but they have little training in this sphere. So in my experience, it is critical to have an expert, be it an expert who happens to be doing therapy, who is in the law also an expert. And I would say parenthetically here that an expert by definition in the law is different than an expert in the world of mental health very often. And that's an important thing for mental health people to know. So you are an expert if you have more than the ordinary person's knowledge in a given area. So even if you're doing treatment and not evaluation, you can be accepted as an expert in most courts. And this is really important. And so when women come to court, and they don't know, and an order gets entered contrary to their welfare or the welfare of the children, they lose power. And if I can kind of toss in something here, my mantra for women who have been abused is take the power you have and use it effectively. And that's kind of a catch-all that at every step, you have to figure out, what power do I have? How can I use it effectively? Because one of the things that abusers know is power. They know when you lose power, and they know when they gain power. And again, abusers can be women. Most often they are men, which is why I use man for abuser and he for abuser and women for victims. And I appreciate your clarifying that. It's clarified in the book as well.
The idea that someone is abusing a spouse or a partner, but could still be seen as a quote-unquote good father. You talk about that in the book. I've certainly heard that a great deal in my office. What do you say to that concept that so-and-so can abuse the spouse but is still a quote-unquote good father?
I think it's important to know that there is, and as a matter of fact, I'm paraphrasing, I don't think I'm quoting, but New Jersey's domestic violence law has a preamble, and it's based on some really old and continuing good research, which says that children suffer deep and long-lasting effects of domestic violence even where they themselves have not been personally abused. And that is a critical thing for everyone to know and for the court to be reminded of. One of the things I speak of in the book is the belief that most courts seem to have that if children are somehow just, the parents are somehow separated, that then the children will be fine. And what that does is absolutely ignores the impact on the child of having just lived in that home environment where their parent has been abused, where they've been, even whether or not it's been physical or whether it's been emotional. Most statutes, in fact, I'm not sure of any statute that makes a distinction between emotional abuse and physical abuse. They have a similar impact on both the adult victim and often worse on the child victim.
In fact, and now I'm quoting you, you say children who have witnessed violence in the home against the parent or lived in homes where violence existed suffered deep and long-lasting emotional effects. I mean, essentially, it's what you've just said. But it bears repeating because so many times, as you know, and certainly as I've heard in my office, there's this distinction that is not a real distinction. It's not an accurate distinction. You don't have to be physically hit in order to be harmed, and you certainly don't have to show physical scars in order to have been abused, whether you are an adult or whether you are a child.
And yet courts don't often understand that. They are not often in tune with that. And that is one of the reasons that it is up to the mental health person, not just me or another lawyer, arguing that that be the case. It also goes back to the question you asked earlier about why you need a lawyer that has the specialized training. Lawyers tend to be taught to be reactive rather than proactive, especially in family court. And it is really important, in my experience, for lawyers who are dealing with victims, whether they be child victims or adult victims, to be proactive, to especially figure out ways to help the victim take the power they have and use it effectively. And it's not to get back at someone. That's another critical piece. This is never designed to get back at the other parent. It's never designed for vengeance. It is only designed for the welfare and protection of the parent and really, most importantly, the children.
What do you say to the parents who tell their legal representatives about suspected or known abuse by the other parent and are told, don't bring it up, the courts won't believe it, it'll come back to haunt you, you'll lose your child? What do you say to the parents?
Well, it usually happens that, what in my experience, I hear about it very frequently after that has already happened. And they have had, they listen to the attorney, you know, women and men both go to attorneys who they believe will know something about the system and how to do what's necessary. And they rely on that, not what they believe is that knowledge. Unfortunately, all too often to their detriment and to the detriment of their children. So if I get called beforehand, I tell them simply, I think you're using the wrong attorney and you need someone who will take that information and bring it to the court in a way which puts it before the court so the court doesn't get told later about it, because that is one of the problems that occurs. It comes up later. Women will say, no, you can't do that, court, because it's not good. And it then looks like they're just trying, as the courts would say, to get a leg up in a custody dispute as opposed to really protecting their children. So they've been pushed back, set back a great deal. Whereas if you raise it in the beginning, and I tell both attorneys and parent mothers, bring it up right at the get-go. one of the things that we know, if it's a divorce and you put it in a complaint for divorce, it's there for all time. And when they say, oh, she never brought it up before, it's in the divorce. The judge may not be looking at the complaint, which is the initiating pleading that is written when one comes for a divorce. Likewise, if one goes for a restraining order, to put the history there, and if the children were present, it will be there for all time. The other thing I tell women is listen to your gut. Do not ever set aside your own value system for what somebody else is telling you. Listen to your gut. Go back to tuning into it, because most battered women that I have worked with somehow set that aside. And if you set it aside, you're setting your, quote, self aside. You have to begin to be back in tune with that self, with what your gut tells you is right. If it says it's wrong, listen. Argue with your attorney. Fight with your attorney. If you can bring in someone who understands, bring your therapist in who understands, or a mental health person that understands. One other piece of this, and that is if you get sent to an evaluation and the evaluator doesn't seem to get it, there may be many ways to rectify that as well. So we could talk about that, but that's just something for women to know.
Well, you're saying that a woman or the person who's been harmed should listen to their gut. I certainly agree with that, but you also acknowledge that the listening to your gut is one of the first thing that falls by the wayside as the abuser begins his or her work of really sort of, you know, training his or her victim to stay in the relationship and to do what they're told. So the idea of listening to your gut for somebody who's not been in that relationship makes perfect sense, and it's great advice, and it's almost a given. It's an instinct. But for somebody who hasn't, for somebody who's been taught not to listen to their gut, that can be quite a stretch.
You know, I'm so glad you asked me that. In my experience, when I'm litigating and I say to someone who has been battered badly and over a period of time, I try to have a conversation with them very, very early on about what they might have said or thought or felt before the relationship. And I'm not a therapist, and I don't pretend to be one, and I very often recommend that they enter therapy with someone competent who understands it. But what I have found as an attorney is I often say, when I talk to them going back in time, what would they have thought then, they are tuning in with their gut. The other thing that I have found is taking a good history. Maybe it's a good time to mention, my father was a psychologist. And I remember when I first started doing this work, he would tell me about the importance and the critical nature of a history in doing therapy, good therapy for a patient. And I realized right away when people would say they were battered and they'd given me examples and pieces didn't fit, that I had to find a way to make it fit, and so that I could understand it if I was going to present it to a court. And the question that I began to ask was, when you first started to date, I was trying to understand how they got ensconced in this. And what I would say is, tell me when you first started to go out or interact with this person, and you had your first disagreement, tell me about that, and tell me about how it resolved, and whether they remembered the precise first or the second. And what I found, there was a similarity among battered women, and that similarity was they would capitulate. They would go along with, to their own detriment, until they had set aside their own, quote, self over a period of time. And what batterers know is women who that these people could be victimized. They could take advantage of that, whether it's emotionally, initially emotionally, and at some later point, the threat of violence. And then with that, if people can get back in touch, can't even tell you how many women would go, oh my gosh, I forgot about that. I forgot about that. And they would set aside their own interests for somebody else to keep the peace, usually, or to make somebody happy. Well, that's fine if it's reciprocal, to go along with what someone else wants. It's not okay if it's setting yourself aside.
Absolutely.
And your own interests aside. And women do come to understand that. That's been my experience.
Toby Kleinman, co-author of Winning in Family Court. We are going to take a break and we will return. Don't go away, folks. As I'm thinking about our conversation today, I'm reminded of, sadly, more than one instance of learning about situations where a parent would have inappropriate contact with a child, sleeping in bed together, taking showers together, you name it. And when it was brought up in court, and this was several years ago, when it was brought up in court, as you've said in your book and as you've said today, the parent who brought it up was seen as the guilty party, if you will. Has it gotten any better? Is there any more awareness that sexual abuse and molestation occurs in the home?
From an academic point of view, yes, I'm sure there is more awareness. Whether there's more awareness in court, I haven't seen it. I haven't seen the courts more sensitized to the impact of inappropriate behavior on children. There are courts that give lip service to it, but there are courts that do it well. I don't want to put down every court. I've seen a lot of courts be very sensitive to the needs and welfare of children. So it isn't every court. But as I think I point out in the book, upwards of 70% of the named abusers named by the child get custody of their children after abuse is brought to the court. And it happens for many reasons, but in answer to your question, I can't really say that the statistics are improving. I don't see it, or hopefully they wouldn't need me anymore to be a part of it. And the calls just don't stop.
I was hoping for a different answer, but I'm not surprised. The idea that abusers would get custody of their children, you know, again, from someone on the outside looking in who doesn't really have a familiarity with all that happens in a courtroom setting, it just simply doesn't make any sense. It just seems like the courts would know better. And you make this point that a lot of times victims of abuse will just sort of naturally assume that the courts will know what they don't know. It doesn't make any sense that someone who is hurting a child will then be given charge of that child and unsupervised charge of that child.
No, this is one of the things that I must say I still find shocking. But what happens is, very often, first of all, I attribute a lot of it to poor custody evaluators. People who are untrained in domestic violence, and or untrained in child abuse, and or untrained in child sexual abuse, and who do not therefore do proper evaluation. I will also say that state-to-state child protection agencies don't even have to necessarily investigate, and I've seen some of the worst investigations by state child protective services. So those are important pieces. But there is another thing that the courts see, and this is really problematic, and sometimes they go hand in hand. So, and sometimes they're independent. A court may appoint an evaluator who is not properly trained. An attorney doesn't necessarily look into their credentials, so he or she may not know they're not properly trained. The evaluator then sees the parent, the mother who has been abused for a period of time and whose child is now being physically, emotionally, or sexually abused by that parent, would rightfully be angry, upset, distraught, any number of high emotional reactions which would be appropriate to the circumstance, but the evaluator doesn't treat them that way. They call them hysterical. Then they see a distraught parent in court and this abuser father seeming cool, calm, and collected. It goes hand in hand with what the words and the written word of the evaluator is, that mother's hysterical, father is a good guy, mother's making it up. And one of the critical, so that's how it happens. And one of the critical things is to unspin the words of the abuser. Unspin what they say. It is not a mother's accusation if a child has made the accusation. It always needs to be unspun so that it is clear, I am not the child, this is not my accusation, although I am bringing it to the court. It is what the child has said occurred. He or she has said it to his or her therapist, has said it to me, has perhaps said it to a teacher. I'm not making it up. And then you need someone who is adept and knowledgeable in the area of coaching, because fathers invariably say, oh, the mother has coached. She just doesn't want me to have contact. And it goes on from there.
So it sounds like you're saying there is almost potentially a built-in bias with some courts, not all, to disbelieve children and women.
Yes. Yes, but I think it starts with, I'm uncomfortable a little bit with the word bias, because it starts with the lack of knowledge.
Okay.
So, you know, and that's, they don't really know. And if you don't know, it's easy to have what seems logical. What I have found works very often are analogies. I love analogies because judges often come to the, and this I believe probably is a bias, where they come to the belief that, you know, all right, 6 months ago, you've been away from him in 6 months, get over it. You should be, you know, beyond it. And I come up with analogies, and here's one that I have used that has been effective. Judge, if you were walking down the street with your wife and you, you know, you had just finished dinner and you're walking to your car and somebody comes out of the blue, grabs your wife's purse, punches her in the face, and knocks her down. And lucky you, they find this person, they try him, they put him in jail after 6 months, 8 months, 9 months, whatever it is, 2 months, maybe probation. And at some point, 2 years down the road, you're walking down the street again. Maybe it's in the middle of a Saturday afternoon shopping, and you suddenly think you see this person coming down the street. Are you going to be cool, calm, and collected, or is your heart going to race? Because you don't know what's going to happen. I don't believe you're going to stand there and wait to see if it happens again. You're likely going to cross the street or go into a store or do something. You are not going to just stand there. Imagine if you lived in a home where that occurred and you didn't know when, if, how, or under what circumstances you were going to be beaten, put down, or attacked, or your children were. It's not just going to go away because these two people are separated, especially if there's not even an ounce of remorse expressed by that person.
And I can see that really ringing true to a judge in a different way.
What do you mean?
I can see it with that kind of analogy, a judge really understanding the point that you're making.
Oh, yes. Okay, good. Yeah, this is a very, I tell attorneys all the time, come up with an analogy. Come up with something from their potential real life circumstance that people who were not engaged in this litigious battle, as it is known, because there is an innate belief that you are engaged in litigation and that there's choice. And most women that I know who have been victims aren't choosing to litigate. They would love to resolve it, and they tend to minimize everything until they're forced to raise it.
What's your thought about mediation when abuse is in the picture?
Well, mediation by definition to me should never be done when there is abuse. And the reason for that is, and there are many states that don't permit it. Excuse me. Because by definition, to mediate, you have to be equal. And you are not equal if you are there is an abuser and a victim. So by definition, these two people can't really successfully mediate because one person is more powerful than the other.
So it is reasonable, it would seem to me, if the abused person is being recommended for mediation, that he or she really begin to question whether or not the person doing the recommending does have the training necessary to adequately represent.
To adequately mediate, you mean?
No, to adequately represent him or her in any in any sort of procedure. If they're recommending mediation, which assumes that there is equality among the parties, which there automatically isn't if there's domestic abuse, then it becomes clear that the person who's making that recommendation doesn't really know what they're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, this is a perfect example that you've raised of a circumstance where the victims, most of the victims would likely know as soon as mediation is recommended, how can I possibly do mediation?
Right.
Now, I will say that there are some states that are now permitting mediation where there has been abuse. And what I'm hearing about that is that they are doing it where the victim is not with the perpetrator. I still don't like it. I still don't think it is an equal, that they're on equal footing. But it's apparently now being done as a way to try to short-circuit litigation.
You make the point that in the case of a long-standing relationship in which now that it's coming to an end and the parent is objecting to custody, that the judge may view this as a bit ridiculous. They've lived together for X number of years. The children have been living in the same household for X number of years. Why now is there a concern about custody? What do you say to those people who are in that situation?
So one of the things I say in the book, or I believe early on, is the critical nature, and I mentioned it earlier to you, the history. And the court needs to be made aware of the history. And then the bridge to how this person is finally beginning to extricate themselves and why. And very often, I have found it has to do with the children. They finally see something where it's impacting not only them, but it's also impacting the children. Or they've been threatened for many years. If you ever leave me, I will take the kids. If you ever do this, I will do this. So it isn't a matter of just doing it. Also, research has shown that victims of abuse are most at risk when they really leave.
Yeah.
That there are multiple attempts to leave before they actually make a final departure. And that they are actually most at risk. And I think I read something recently that most of the deaths of women in this country, now let me not throw that out as a possibility, but they don't just leave. That leaving is a complicated process for victims of abuse.
It is indeed complicated, and it does require planning in order to effect it safely.
Yes, and there are shelters. I have worked with shelters. I've worked with women who have been in shelters and where their spouses have found them in the shelter, where other women then become victims or potential victims. So it does, and the judges need to have the connections made. And that's where it's incumbent upon the attorney to get the information first from the women and then to make the connection. These cases are labor intensive. And some attorneys who may be competent, this is another real problem, who may be actually competent to do them properly, the women can't afford them. And then attorneys are, you know, doing short-circuited versions of what they might do because it is expensive. If they did it the proper way, it's huge amount of time and attention.
And abusers know that.
Absolutely, they know it, yes.
And
they know the power.
Yes. And if they can run the money out on the other person's side, they get what they want, which is, you know, what they enjoy, which is maintaining the power and control.
It is what they do. And one of the things they tend to do is use the court system. And they often have more money to fight the longer battle. And they often, therefore, don't care if they do it, if they spend it. And when the judges see the women then coming back and then perhaps fighting about money as well as fighting about the children, the courts don't necessarily see the distinction that they should be seeing, that they are forced to also fight about money. So it becomes an additional problem to the already complex one of the litigation about custody. I often tell women, don't let that battle, if you can possibly help it, happen at the same time. Deal with the issue of the children, then deal with the issue of the money, if you can find a way to do that.
And it can be very difficult. Toby Kleinman, we are going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. Toby, I think through your, I know, through our conversation today and certainly through your book, you have made it very clear how critically important it is that the people with whom one chooses to engage in this kind of an issue really need to have the training that will allow them to properly represent the individual who's coming to them for help. How does the woman, the man or the woman find out what kind of training the person has had? What kind of training should they look for?
Well, in this day and age, most everybody has a CV, can be found online. But I have also found that word of mouth is very good. Calling the local women's organizations, again, most of these victims are women. So calling a battered woman's shelter, calling a woman's organization. There are some national organizations such as Child Justice, the VV Leap at George Washington Law School, which is the Domestic Violence Legal Empowerment Appeals Project, run by Joan Meyer. There are places that tend to be known that people can check out who they are, whose name they have been giving. But I would say the first thing to do is get online, get a CV, get a resume, and see on there not what just what they claim to do, but what is their actual training. What programs have they done? Have they written on a subject? Have they presented on a subject? What subject? To what organizations do they belong? To what divisions of their psychologists of American Psychological Association do they belong? To what other organizations do they belong? And then look up for those organizations and see what they stand for. You have to be proactive in this and not just do something because their name came across their attorney's desk and their attorney assures them, yes, this person, I've used them many, many, many times. Well, they may have used them many, many, many times and there may have been no domestic violence, or they may have used them many, many, many times and the domestic violence victim didn't fare very well. So it isn't about knowing them. It's about actually being proactive and checking them out that way.
So that's an example of taking the power you have and using it effectively.
Absolutely.
And if you don't feel safe doing that research at home, you can do that research at a library or someplace else. And, you know, with a lot of these sites that are specifically geared, I know that you know this, geared towards providing information for folks who are victims of violence, there's a quick escape button in case somebody's walking in the room and you don't want them to see what kind of site you're looking at. So doing some online work is safer than it's been before, and there's lots of information available.
Yes.
Can you do anything about the judge? You're not going to ask a judge what his or her experience is.
Well, judges are supposed to have proper training and adequate training. So this is a perfect example of when do you, judges will encourage people to settle rather than to try a case. And cross-examination at a hearing of either an initial hearing, a preliminary hearing, a hearing in the middle, or even a final trial, is cross-examination is the searchlight for the truth. So if judges have been trained, and you have a competent attorney who can do proper cross-examination because they have the correct information, that will also help if they have a bad evaluator. But they also can get their own experts. Now, not every state allows you to get your own expert and have an evaluation of the other party right away. But at some point, you can do that. Now, money may be an issue there. It's true. So there are all kinds of issues that, such as money, that can arise. But I would say that if you, I see each courtroom, I've heard, let me back up for a minute. I've sometimes heard horrible stories about a judge And I've gone in and I've read then transcripts of the things he or she has said and read the kinds of things that appear to be biased. And you have to kind of sift through those and then begin to teach that judge, assuming they are open-minded, you have to go in with that assumption, what the information they are going to need. This is, again, taking the power you have. What information do they need so that if you bring that to them, a reasonable person hearing it would see that your child or you need certain kinds of protections, or both of you need certain protections. It is not easy to recuse a judge, and very frequently seeking to recuse, recusing meaning getting rid of that particular judge in a particular case. Most states allow that judge to make their own decision about whether or not to get out if you seek to have them removed. Most of them will not agree to be removed, and therefore it's not usually a good idea to do so. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's appropriate, and sometimes you just want to bring to the court's attention some of the things that seem in conflict and which may show bias, and ask them to search their own heart, and if they are biased, to consider removing themselves.
Does that work?
It has. I've seen it work. Sometimes what they will do is lean over to give you more of it. They won't get out, but they may give you more of an opportunity to say things or bring things up or raise things that they might not otherwise be willing to do if you put certain things about them on the record. And that's another thing. I believe in being fearless. That doesn't mean be stupid and put anything and say anything, but it means don't be frightened. Make a good judgment. And if you think this may have a positive impact, even if the judge isn't going to like it, sometimes it's important to be able to say certain things. Sometimes, for example, I recommend don't have in-chambers meetings where you're talking off the record. Say to the judge, "Judge, I like to do everything on the record." Because judges will put pressure on you behind the scenes that they will not do on the record. Not all judges, but some.
So as an attorney, you can ask that everything be on the record?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And you don't want to blame your client for it. I've seen attorneys say, "My client wants everything on the record." And that makes them feed into bad evaluators who often call these women paranoid. So I'm going to back up a long way to an earlier question. We have another minute to do an explanation here.
Yes.
One of the things that often would happen is women would come in. I'd see an evaluation where women were labeled borderline and paranoid. They'd be telling me that they were battered, and I'd see the evaluation borderline and paranoid. So I would call an expert in domestic violence, get their test results, get this, and they say, sure, they misinterpreted a particular test because, they might, if they hadn't been battered, be seen as paranoid. But it is appropriate to be concerned about where your spouse is, whether you're being followed, if you've been beaten, if you've been harassed, if you've been stalked, so that it may be appropriate to the circumstance, so that these are all things that are subject to interpretation.
You bring up the term stalked. Can you just say a little bit about what stalking is and whether it is legal or illegal?
I don't know any state that stalking is legal. Definitionally, I don't want to give you a definition because the trouble with my doing so is it varies from state to state. But it is essentially somebody being there in an ever-present way where they are unwanted, waiting outside your home, waiting outside your office every day, calling continuously, showing up in places where you happen to go regularly and being there. It's inappropriate presence. And I don't want to go further than that to a definition again, because it varies state to state. Sometimes there's a number of times it has to happen. Sometimes there's sometimes a distinction between harassment and stalking. So it would really depend on the particular state's definition.
But that, what you have shared is very useful, because there could certainly be those listening who would say, well, this person does these kinds of things, but he or she has never hit me, so I don't think I can really go and get help, because all they do is fill in the blanks. They call me 50 times a day, or they show up wherever I am and they stare at me, but they don't, they've never really hit me or touched me. So I thank you for that, for the information that you did share about stalking. I think it's important for people to know. You say that it's important for an attorney to find out the ways in which a client feels vulnerable. And I was really struck by that. Can you say more about why that is so important?
Well, it's critical. You're dealing with an individual. You are not dealing with a group of people. When you represent someone, you are representing a person, and that person, and knowing that person's individual sense of vulnerability is critical to your proper representation. If they've been victimized and you do not know and or understand that victimization and where they might actually be vulnerable, for example, or feel vulnerable. For example, when I was going to court and representing victims, never left someone sitting in a hall by themselves where the perpetrator might just even walk by and give them a glaring stare, even if they wouldn't harm them, because it would elicit all kinds of fear responses quite naturally. So it's a matter of knowing that sometimes going and patting your adversary on the back can make somebody feel very uncomfortable. You may know each other and have been adversaries, you know, 30, 40, 50 times. But if you do that in the presence of your attorney, of your client, it may very well make them feel, is he or she going to really represent me when they go into court? Is this an act? Or is she just doing, being buddy-buddy? How can that other person, how can he or she be buddy-buddy with somebody who, you know, is representing such a horrible person as my husband or ex-husband?
So, it's important to pay attention. One of the things that I appreciated so much about what you're saying today, and certainly what you've written, is the, what's the word I'm looking for? It's the awareness and the specificity with which you really delve into all of the nuances that go into the experience of domestic abuse and go into the representation of it. I mean, even being clear that leaving a client alone in a hallway in a courthouse, that's something that you are aware of that any number of attorneys might not even think twice about. You know, they're in the courthouse. Who's going to bother them in the courthouse? May not even think about it, but you have the awareness to think about it.
Thank you.
You talk about the importance of using domestic violence sensitive knowledge and language by the court. Give us an example of what you mean and why that is so important in your view.
Okay. So a judge sitting in the in his chair looks at two people, he enters an order, and even if it's a good order, let's say he's done the right thing by the order. Let's give up the best of all hypotheticals here. And then he looks at the husband and wife, and he says, look, moving forward, I really expect the two of you to get along. You've got two kids. You've got to find a way for those kids. Now, to the abuser, that's a message of empowerment. He knows he's got more power right then and there, but the judge doesn't get it. To to the victim, she's going, oh my, how can I suddenly get along with this monster? I can't get along with somebody who's going to hit me, hurt my kids. I'm still going to fight for my kids to be supervised. I'm not giving up, but they feel powerless. Whereas if a judge were to look at that couple and say, look, I get it. There's been domestic violence here. I understand the kids are still suffering. I'm giving it a shot, Mr. So-and-so. I'm going to let you see your kids unsupervised. But I don't want to have any problems. I don't want to hear these kids coming back and saying you're doing X, Y, Z, A, B, and C. And mom, I want you to really give him a chance. Maybe now that you are separated and you have your own space and he's out of the house and you maybe now he will change his behavior. And I want to give him the benefit of the doubt for the moment. So in that case, example, he would not have given the best order. It would have been an order as I just described it in his. But the man would have known he's on notice. The judge gets it. He's being watched. And the woman, too, while she may not feel comfortable or happy or glad with what the order would be, would know that she's got a welcome space to come back to if there's a problem.
She's got options.
Yes. And so he's really saying the same thing in terms of what the judge expects, but he is doing it in a way that gives a clear message that is going to be understood by both people in a clear way that's important for them to understand, not an empowering way to the abuser.
Toby G. Kleinman, co-author with Daniel Pollack of Domestic Abuse, Child Custody and Visitation, Winning in Family Court. Again, I have to thank you so much for the work that you do and for the work that you have put into this book. Is there a website that you can share with the listeners?
Oh, boy. I don't have a website. I have an email address. I'm happy to give it out if you'd like.
Okay.
So people could contact me. It's Toby, T-O-B-Y, @ AdlerKleinman.com, AdlerKleinman.com.
Terrific. Thank you very much again, Toby Kleinman, for joining us today.
You're welcome, Pamela. It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications, and it is available to you on demand at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. You can also download the free Mind Talk app from the iTunes Store or the Google Play Store. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to Mind Talk, so send me an email with that information and any questions or comments you may have to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, @ mindtalk.org. Again, that's mindtalk.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.